Blog Talk Radio.
Because that is the reality of the Enfer Boruchu, Enfer and Blessed Be. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Perhaps you might be in that time zone of good evening. We're alive because we want to stay alive. In Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachmin, instructions of mercy. This happens to be now Soul Class number 299, Torah and Naturopathic Medicine. This will hopefully be our first of many programs. Blessed is our Creator. We are rejoicing over our new endeavor to introduce, which will hopefully become a new and vibrant and vital feature in the Soul Talk realm of consciousness. Not only do we hope to have, I have actually to my right side Dr. Ben Sarlin, a naturopath doctor who will discuss, hopefully within the next 45 minutes, as much as he can. And again, if we can't get it all today, but those we hope to have a continuing series of this, who will discuss comprehensive approaches towards not only getting healthy, but staying healthy, and why it is important for all human beings to participate actively in their own personal wellness, and not just be passive pill ingesters with the euphoric expectation that if they take two pills at night, all they have to do is call their doctor in the morning, and everything will be okay, like it's portrayed by mass media distortions of what is proper health, driven insidiously, unfortunately, by corporate interests, which, to our great pain, are too many times not on the side of empowering the entire human family experience. By the way, Dr. Sohn has a website I'd like to make you aware of. You can go to it by going to www.drbensarlin.com as well. He has a wonderful book, which hopefully we'll be discussing as well today and in hopefully future programs, called everything they don't teach at Harvard Medical School. H, a diet for a small planet. Meanwhile, blessed souls, here live at Turtle Island, aka the USA, I implore you to breathe deeply, reduce your worries, because the Ein Sof Infinite Creator is running the show, and we should try to connect to the eternal show to the best of our ability. That being said, blessed souls, we're talking about the concept of healing, which in the Hebrew, Lashon HaKodesh, is known as refuah. For within the dimensions of Panimiyot HaTorah, the inner dimensions of Torah, there is a process of hamtachat adinim, the sweetening of judgments which have been incurred by the person who is sick. For sickness, according to Panimiyot HaTorah, reflects a lack of something. Now, I've drawn up four general scenarios, not as a medical practitioner, as a layman, who's experienced these four scenarios, and perhaps you have as well. Sickness can be incurred to a compromise within our immune system. Sickness can be incurred by improper digestion, leading to sickness. As well, sickness can be incurred by some sort of bodily injury which triggers this sickness. And as well, last but not least, which unfortunately a lot of people are plagued with in the United States of America, and probably many parts of the world as well, is a lack of proper sleep of some sort over a specific pronounced time, and that can trigger stress, which in fact can trigger the sickness or the disease. Now, what I've said to you is what I've heard from other doctors in my time, in my 51 years to be blessed and known to be on the planet Earth, and as well, just the fifth scenario is that there can be many other scenarios. So in reaction to the four general triggering agents for sickness, we all know this, the human family experience has always sought certain systems of treatment or certain individuals who have internalized what I would like to call a certain crown of consciousness, a Keser Afkara, to sweeten the judgments, which we talked about before, which are connected to, according to causing sickness in an individual. And then the person bearing this crown of consciousness seeks to diagnose the particular sickness incurred by that person, and then will then try to implement modes, which we hope and pray and bless will be successful modes of treatment of sickness, which actualize, according to Torah, the inner dimension of Torah, a middle path of sweetening such judgments which cause the sickness, and that is called accessing the Midah of Teferis, beauty, which is a process of integrating sometimes severe methods and as well sweet, loving, nurturing approaches, which are precisely accessible within the empowerment process, which is connected directly to the Creator's four-letter name, the Yud, and then dash, Hey, dash, Vav, dash, Hey. And this process involves accessing a quality of a crown upon the supernal head, which stands above all forms of wisdom found within the blessed creation, for there is a source of healing, a mocker of refuah, that the human family experience has always sought out. Now, many people might not realize this, but the Torah in the five books talks about the concept of healing from the written and oral tradition. From the oral Torah tradition, I don't know if you know about this, but Abraham, the first patriarch of Israel, was known to have worn a precious gem around his neck, and when people of the generation were sick, they would come to Abraham, speak to him about their sickness. He would ask them upon this precious gem, and he would pray to the Creator of all heaven and earth, and he would be healed. In the book of Numbers, several weeks ago, we read about how the Israelites had rebelled against Hashem, God, and God had instructed Moshe to make a type of totem pole made of brass with a brass snake curled around it. And those Jews who believed that the ultimate sense of their healing would be connected to looking at the source of all healing, not just looking at that brass snake wrapped around a brass pole, they would be healed. And those who didn't, unfortunately, fell. Now, I don't think it's any coincidence that there is a medical symbol today which portrays a snake curled around a pole as a symbol of healing. With that being said, blessed souls, I want to now ask Dr. Solomon, who certainly had the opportunity to go through mainstream medicine, to why he is now pursuing the path of naturopathic medicine. But before that, first of all, I want to thank you, Dr. Solomon. Do you mind if I call you Ben?
Sure.
Okay.
Thanks, Don, for having me.
No, it's my pleasure and honor, and I hope that those who are listening in now live or the future archive versions will come to know you more and more and to reach out for your wisdom. Ben, who have been some of your influences that guide you in the path of not mainstream medicine, but rather to what I think will be future mainstream medicine, naturopathic medicine? Who have been your influences?
Well, the way I started learning was I went to traditional medical school, so really most of my influences were other, you can say, famous physicians who wrote a book on obesity. And my major influences were really scientific until well after medical school. I had a year of nutrition study and have been learning Torah for 15 years. So I wanted to try to integrate my knowledge of science and medicine with some knowledge of Torah, but it was probably well after I had written most of the book that I let the book sit for 2 years so I could acquire more, let's say, spiritual knowledge to round out a book that I could call Everything They Don't Teach at Harvard Medical School, because really in Harvard Medical School all they're going to be teaching is traditional science, not even much nutrition. Most medical students only have, say, 10 weeks of nutrition, which isn't really enough to prevent a holistic, to provide a holistic picture on health. But then I also wanted to fill in not only spiritual lessons, but lessons from other places which we don't incorporate into our knowledge of health, such as from veterinary medicine, animal science, wildlife medicine, answers from nature. And the Torah tells us this. I only learned later after looking at animals that the Torah says that if we never received the Torah, the place we would go to look for answers to our questions is essentially to animals. And most of the major figures in Torah, in the Bible, Abraham and King David and Moses, all had a profound knowledge of nature and animals. They knew far more about farming and animals and the natural cycles and when the moon would appear. They were much more in touch with themselves and their land than we are today. So sometimes people ask,
I might add, they were all farmers. So
yeah,
farmers, I lived on a farm for an extended period of my life. And farmers, they are stigmatized as being kind of yokels, barney ghouls, but they're some of the most intelligent people I've ever met on the face of the earth.
Oh, absolutely. And they get a lot of exercise also. You know, I mean, today people ask me, like, what are we? Are we an agrarian society? Are we a, how are we supposed to eat? What type of diet? Are we Paleolithic? Are we hunter-gatherers? And yeah, the truth of the matter is our ancestors really, the founding fathers, so to speak, were, as you say, farmers. And so what's happened in recent times is we're neither hunter-gatherer or agrarian. We've become essentially a sedentary culture. Whereas they used to wake up in the morning at 6 o'clock and work the land, and they had to do everything physical. All the laundry and all the everything was a physical lifestyle. It allowed them to eat perhaps in a way and burn off a lot of calories. Whereas today, because we have a sedentary culture, I think the largest problem from just a health scientific, a natural perspective, not speaking of Torah, is the biggest problem really more than diet even is a sedentary culture. So today, I think these books that are talking about Paleolithic diets and agrarian diets, Mediterranean diet, it's not really accurate. We have a sedentary society, so meaning, it's not just a diet that's a prescription, but people have to stay active. for good health, and these farmers were active all the time. So when a patient comes to me, the first thing I tell them, you know, my expertise being obesity, if you really want to lose weight, you got to put in the effort. There's no quick pill, and there's no even quick diet that's going to help this person lose 40 pounds. In fact, science shows this, that they have a government database where people who have lost 40 pounds can register their story of how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And the one common thing they had in common was not their diet at all. It was the fact that they were all working out for 45 minutes to an hour and a half, 5 to 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. That was the statistic that most impressed. And the second thing they found in common was everyone had a very static diet, meaning they stuck to a very set plan.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of sticking with it, with a habit, and a habit becoming a, something with few food choices. All
mm-hmm.
these people had not many selections of variety. But the thing is, Torah tells us that a person has to invest physical energy into his daily routine, and that the more effort, the more the reward. And we're rewarded according to the effort. And so a diet alone, I often tell people, you can't lose weight by eating. Because it's not really an effort, you know? I mean, nobody loses weight by eating. Even if you're on a diet and you're eating very little, you have to exercise.
But on July 4th at Coney Island, they're going to make an effort. They call them, I think, gastrointestinal athletes, trying to eat as many hot dogs as they can. I mean, it's such insanity. That has become a sport to see how many hot dogs a person can stuff down their throat. I mean, this itself should be in Ripley's Believe It or Not for the most unlikely sport to be called a sport. But I'd like to get back to one thing. You mentioned about studies in obesity. I mean, as someone who walks in the street and someone who's also dealt with being overweight and now trying to reduce my weight, through exercise, I ride about 70, 80 to 90 minutes a day on my bike, and I see that helps a lot. What triggered you, or what ignited you, what aroused you to, by the concept of obesity? Did you see it back 15 years ago that it was going to become the plague like we see it is today?
Well, today, one out of every approximately two women are obese in America,
mm-hmm.
and one out of three men. So clearly it's a major medical problem, and along with the obesity comes diabetes and high blood pressure. What for me, it was probably just a feeling that I as a kid always had to stay active. I played sports every season, and had I not done that, I probably would have been like Big Elvis, and you know, so it was more just family. I had always been athletic, always reading books on nutrition from a young age. And so I had actually, at some point, I don't know why, chosen to wrestle on a high school wrestling team, and we had to lose a lot of weight.
Right.
So I was always reading diet books, and I remember doing the Atkins diet because maybe I had to lose 10 pounds for a match. And I remember doing Atkins and actually passing out at my friend's swimming pool.
Wow.
And so for years I thought Atkins didn't have the answer, that if someone didn't have carbohydrate in their diet, there wouldn't be enough for the brain. And it made a big impact on me.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
when I went to nutrition school, I started reading more books. And Barry Sears released The Zone Diet. He's probably my biggest influence. He sold over $50 million worth of his books. It's probably the best-selling and really best book on nutrition available now. And he was saying that Atkins had it right, that insulin, in fact, stores our body fat. So when I went to a school of nutrition, they focused only on cholesterol and fat, and so you have these two opposing views.
Uh-huh.
So I was trying to figure out during my year in school who was right. Is it Atkins low-carb or Sears, who's saying something pretty similar to Atkins? Or is it the low cholesterol, low fat people? And my professors in the nutrition school kept saying it was cholesterol and fat. And I would ask them, how is fat made in the body? And I was trying to get an answer to this question from them, but they didn't have an answer.
Uh-huh.
So I spent my year in nutrition school sort of investigating how a molecule of fat is made in the fat cell. And you hear most scientific discoveries are by accident. People just come on discoveries, people like Pasteur discovering bacteria and in a laboratory environment, or someone discovering mushrooms gets rid of of molds in a petri dish, and that these things are all by accident. But I was actively looking for, I was actively reading and trying to find an answer to the question, how does the body make fat? How, something beyond a caloric argument, because what happens is when you go to your doctor's office, you sit down and say, this is my diet, and he says, oh, you're having too many calories, so too many calories is getting fat. And you say, what does that mean? And he says, well, fat has more calories than sugar, and so when your body has more calories that it can burn, you make fat. Okay, but to a student sitting a year in a classroom, that argument has to be meshed out, and they never meshed it out.
Wow.
So I said to myself, here, it's not really an answer. I mean, you can say it's an answer, but a kid doesn't understand that when he goes to the doctor's office. He has no idea what that means, this knowledge of, like, kilojoules and these scientific expressions that are so hard to understand. I wanted them to go on the blackboard, literally show me the pathway from the molecules, the chemicals, constructing the fat molecule, like an engineer would look at it.
Right.
And my favorite book on nutrition is Richard Bernstein's book on diabetes. He's an engineer, and he says he has all these engineering ways of thinking about things. He says small inputs lead to small outputs, meaning if you have a low amount of carbohydrate, you have a low amount of insulin.
Uh-huh.
And that made a lot of sense to me. So I wanted to sort of map it out on a board, how what chemical goes to what chemical. And I found out, I thought I wasn't going to discover this in a year, and it was about the ninth month of school, and I was, you know, I thought I would have to look through dusty books in the basement of the medical school library.
Right.
I was going into antique bookstores. I thought science had to be hard, and I thought, you know, nothing, like I say, in life comes easy. And
right.
So I thought the effort would have to be on the level of Herculean effort to find the answer. But in fact, I was in the Teachers College bookstore, and I opened up just a book of nutritional biochemistry, which is a book we use in nutrition school. And I opened it up, and I was looking for fat synthesis, which is called lipogenesis. And I started reading sugar is the essential rate-limiting reagent in fat synthesis, meaning without a sugar molecule, a fat molecule can't be constructed. So
uh-huh.
I took that to my science department,
uh-huh.
and they told me, you have something interesting here, but it doesn't make sense because this whole institute, our whole university is founded on cholesterol and fat research,
uh-huh.
and even the dean of the school said, you know, I've spent my whole life doing this, I've written a textbook on this, and I said, well, but unfortunately this doesn't appear to be correct.
If I can just comment, my father went to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute up in, I think it's in Rochester, New York, which is a very fine school where he got his master's in mechanical engineering, and he told me that the books he was studying in mathematics in the 1950s became obsolete by the 1960s because some of those mathematical computations were shown to be incorrect in the long range, in the long range vision of where engineering was going, transferring from the 50s to the 60s. So I'm not surprised at what you're telling me. When science is supposed to be objective, but unfortunately there's a certain subjectivity enters and sometimes can poison certain minds when they're interfacing with new information that perhaps they just never thought about before.
Right. You know, and the thing is, you know, going through medical school and rotations in hospitals, most doctors are good people. They're kind people. Half of them are English majors. They're humanitarians. They want to do good.
Interesting.
And so I think largely it's just a question of ignorance. It's not a question of these being bad people. Most of these people
right.
are humanitarians. So the thing is, it's just there is a large pharmaceutical industry, and as the book Everything They Don't Teach at Harvard Medical School will attest, in the first couple of pages, talk about how a student at Harvard Medical School was once asking about the side effects of cholesterol medication, which is rhabdomyolysis. It's a complete breakdown of the muscle tissues.
Mm-hmm.
My mom has gotten this from cholesterol medication. One of my pathology professors was talking to us about the harm of these medications. One of them has been pulled off the market and,
uh-huh.
and subtly changed. But essentially, every cell in your body is made from cholesterol. So when you can't make cholesterol, you can't make estrogen, progesterone, testosterone,
wow.
and you literally cannot make any cell in the body. So the body literally falls apart. Not to mention the fact that cholesterol is not the molecule that's even, like I said, it's not even the correct pathway. Sugar is the backbone on which a fat molecule is built, not cholesterol. So that's the how I opened the book, describing how fat is made, the pathway, trying to break it down to a level a teenager can understand. But what Harvard did is Harvard is one of the largest recipients in funds from the pharmaceutical industry for research. So the average professor at Harvard is paid on somewhere on the order of like $200,000 a year for his research.
Right.
So it, what it does is it clouds their ability to teach the side effects of these medications, because you have these large pharmaceutical companies that are financing their research, so they're not going to speak against them. So the student, he felt like something was going on. Like, okay, this guy is, he was being ridiculed in the middle of the class. So he started meshing it out, and he found out that his professor was being paid, again, like upwards of $50,000 to $200,000 by one of the big, you know, producers of Lipitor,
right,
cholesterol drugs. And he did the research, and students assisted him in the research. And when all the dust cleared, Harvard got an F rating in ethics.
Wow.
From the American College, I think, medical students. And the thing is, people don't consider these things when they choose medical schools, but they really should. The same way I try to compare to people, I tell them, when you buy a product, say people are buying like Apple computers and Apple iPhones, well, did you realize that like the working conditions in the plants are like inhumane, and this would be something you would consider in your purchase of the product? And if you knew that, you know, like 15 workers at Apple's plant committed suicide in 1 year because of the working conditions, they're not allowed to talk to each other in these factories. They have fires because of the aluminum, which is a totally toxic metal used,
wow,
in the processing of the computers. They have fires, people get sick and die. But it's a total military company, and people don't consider this when they're buying products. Or HP computers, you have corporate scandals where people were spying on people within the company, and they're rated one of the worst companies to work for, one of the top 10 worst companies to work for in America. And so people are not taking ethical considerations when they buy a product. And it's the same in medicine. If you're going to choose a medical school, or you're going to even choose the medical profession, I would say think again. If I had to do it all over again, I would have gone to a naturopathic school of medicine where they teach pharmacology and they teach herbal medicine. And a lot of people don't realize pharmaceuticals are now the leading, third leading cause of death in the world and in our country.
Wow.
Right after, you know, people on chemotherapy and heart disease. And so the three leading killers, interestingly, are heart medications. They're all related to the heart, actually. They're calcium channel blockers, diuretics for high blood pressure, and aspirin, which is being used. And the side effects of aspirin are internal bleeding, problems with the kidney and the liver, and it actually, just taking a simple aspirin every day can, you know, lead to like thousands of mortalities. Calcium channel blockers are probably the biggest problem, and diuretics people use for blood pressure. There's a lot of mineral loss, and it leads to a lot of heart irregularities. And even people don't realize, like when I was a kid, we used to take allergy medicine. It's called Celgene. It's an antihistamine. There are also histamine receptors on the heart and in the brain. And so when the histamine was binding to the heart, it was causing fatal arrhythmias.
Wow.
So that medication had to be removed. Just a simple antihistamine can do someone in.
Wow.
And so people often say, well, I'm taking cholesterol medications. I don't feel this muscle weakness. I mean, maybe there's a little weakness, but that only affects like 5%. And I say, see, it's not the way it works. The same way antihistamines bind to histamine receptors on the histamine blockers for your allergy in your lungs, they're also binding to receptors in the heart and the brain. So all medications, we have to relook at how we view the side effects of medications. There are receptors throughout the body, and if you're going to find a receptor in the lungs and it's 100% effective at curing allergies, you also have to think that it's going to be 100% effective binding that same receptor in your heart and in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a 10% risk of side effects. If you believe a medication is 90% effective, it's going to be 90% effective binding to receptors in the heart and in
right.
the brain. So it can't be effective binding receptors one place and then only 15% effective binding in the heart and the head, and so the side effects are only...
Uh-huh.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So...
It's pretty heavy stuff.
You know,
I just like to backtrack a little bit, but as a doctor, you know, there's Webster Dictionary definitions of obesity, there's the American Medical Association. Is obesity something which is particular to each individual, or do you also hold by a general standard? In general, I mean, how would you define as a doctor obesity? That people, hopefully when they hear this definition, will want to make a certain change in their life about reducing their obesity if their body type or their health applies to your definition.
So the thing is, everyone has a slightly different metabolism. And so the thyroid dictates our metabolism, how fast we burn the food. So when I was in medical school, I sat next to a girl who looked, you know, she was tall and thin, and she could, you know, I was constantly bringing her cookies and candy, and she could eat all day and not get fat because she had a thyroid. So most supermodels, most actresses have a very good thyroid. They're tall and thin, and they have thin bone. That's when you know you're in good shape. You can eat a lot more than most people.
Right.
That's a good thing. And then there are people in the middle, like me, who the thyroid's okay, but you have to do a little exercise because, you know, things like CoQ10, which is found in olive oil, can help improve your metabolism. Coconut oil helps the thyroid. Seaweed is high in iodine, helps the thyroid. But really, it's mostly exercise. So you have this type of person who's sitting next to me, and I say to her, you know, from what I'm researching and what I'm reading about sugar right now, you know, it's not just, I took a year off of medical school to actually write this book, so when I came back, I had a lot of information laying. I was telling my friend who sat next to me, this tall, thin girl, she's like 6 feet tall, she'd probably be like an actress, and I said to her, you know, even though you're eating these cookies and the sugar, there's another effect which should make you open your eyes. It's not just about obesity, it's also about heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
Diabetes is the leading cause of heart disease. So you can extract from that knowledge that sugar is the leading cause of heart disease. So I said to her, what happens is when you eat all these cookies and candies and you burn it off, you have to imagine like pouring glue on someone's arteries. You can drip that glue across someone's arteries only for so long until that glue sticks. So essentially what sugar is a bit like glue. So if we were to teach kids in elementary school how to make glue, you would take cornstarch and you would stir it into water, and that would make like a paste. So every time someone eats, they have this paste inside of them, and it's going through the intestines. So when they open up cadavers, they find this white glue on the inside of the intestines.
Wow.
So it's really not just obesity. Someone's got to keep in mind that even if you're thin, even if you have a fast metabolism, and even if you're 40 and you're still thin, it's actually these thin people, because they don't produce a lot of insulin also, possibly, also that stores the fat when they eat sugar. They're not storing fat, so it stays circulating in the artery, and the sugar eventually crystallizes. It turns to either, you could visualize it either, like I said, as like Elmer's glue, you could visualize it as caramel, you could visualize it as rock candy, if you want, but essentially that's what happens to the arteries throughout the body, and it happens. And this is why high blood sugar or a high carbohydrate diet, it's not obesity that's our major concern, it's high blood pressure and the effect on the arteries. So this is why high blood sugar is now the leading cause of damage to arteries throughout the body. So someone thin and tall, just because they look out on the outside, doesn't mean their arteries are clean. They have as much risk, if not more risk, because they're not converting into fat, which is somewhat protective. The sugar is being converted into fat. Most of the sugar we eat is converted to fat. About 80% of the sugar we eat is converted to fat. The rest stays circulating into the arteries, caramelizing. It's the leading cause of retinal disease, coronary disease, kidney disease, and sexual dysfunction. Now, if someone knew sexual dysfunction was a side effect of eating too much pasta, potatoes, cereal, and rice, they might consider that's a good reason to switch, not just obesity.
Or to reach for these ED drugs. Like, whatever, I don't know even what they were. What's the famous one that has a lot of side effects?
The ephedra?
No, for the people who have sexual dysfunctionality.
Viagra.
Viagra, yes.
Right.
But, so you brought up something about the sugar clogging up the arteries. Now, it's very interesting. It's so paradoxical that the very same Coca-Cola, which I've heard, if you pour it on the top of your car, will remove the paint so easily, is the same Coca-Cola with the, I mean, I think, personally, I don't have any science or statistics behind it. I personally think they've added more sugar into Coca-Cola over the years. I believe, because I remember it used to be, I don't know, it just seemed like in a 20-ounce bottle of Coke, there's like 39 grams of sugar, which is astronomical.
Right.
So that same Coca-Cola, which could take the paint off the side of a car, is actually when it gets inside the body, it's actually clogging up the system.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to take all the sugar in the Coca-Cola, like 30 grams of sugar, and stir that into butter, it would make caramel.
Uh-huh.
So because our arteries are fat, when you stir sugar into our arteries fat. So when you stir sugar into the fat, it becomes caramel. So you get this like sugar sticking to the fat, and then you have this immune response because your body's saying, I don't recognize this caramel. I don't recognize this mixture of glue and caramel and rock candy stuck to my artery, which just stuck to the fat in my artery. Let's get it out of here. So the immune system starts attacking your arteries, and then you get these foam cells filled with cholesterol. The cholesterol is not what's causing the disease of the artery. It's just the innocent bystander. It's the sugar that caused the immune attack. And then your white blood cells start spraying the arteries with peroxide mm-hmm. and trying to break up the plaque. And now today, we used to think this was irreversible. Now, we know today through natural medicine, they use high-dose vitamin C. You can clear, or they say chelate, this calcium plaque from the body. So if someone takes a high dose of, the best way is to get it from peppers or broccoli, mm-hmm. is the highest amount of vitamin C. You can slowly...
The sweet peppers or the spicy peppers?
Regular sweet peppers. And they've done x-ray studies. One of the owners of a vitamin C company, who's like 90-something now, he did x-ray studies on this, and he found out that like a couple of months after high-dose vitamin C, before the arteries were opaque, meaning they were filled with calcium, and 3, 4, 6 months later, on the x-ray, the arteries were clear. So he made me a big proponent of vitamin C, and one of the things I give patients, I tell every patient to take, is a vitamin C from a berry. It's a natural herbal supplement from berries that are very high concentrated doses of vitamin C. And like I say, like my book has all these lessons from animals. Like we're primates. We're not primates. We're humans, and primates are primates, but we're more similar to primates. And primates are the only animal which doesn't make its own vitamin C.
Uh-huh.
Humans don't make vitamin C.
Uh-huh.
So if you take 2,000 mammals out there, there's only one that doesn't make vitamin C, and it's a primate. We happen to be like that primate.
Uh-huh.
We have
uh-huh.
essentially humans an inability to make vitamin C. So
mm-hmm.
you have to look at the government tells us to get 50 milligrams of vitamin C a day. That's not going to prevent scurvy. That's the amount required to prevent mortality. So what I did is I looked at primates and how much they get in nature is 5,000 milligrams a day, which is 5 grams of vitamin C. Humans are not getting that. I mean, people say they drink a glass of orange juice, not to mention the fact that orange juice is all sugar water. Anyway, there's as much
right.
orange juice. I put in my book the top 5 worst foods to increase obesity. Orange juice is number one, because orange juice and grape juice have about 3 chocolate bars worth of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way to do it. The way to do it is vegetables high in vitamin C. But
uh-huh.
we have a real need for this, and so we have to look at animals. So our best lesson on vitamin C comes from the animals, and if people were to look more at animals and take lessons from veterinary medicine and apply them to human medicine, we'd have a lot more lessons. And what happens now, essentially, when a human looks in the mirror, he's trying to figure out, how do I eat? So he says, well, let me look at how the Japanese eat and how the French eat and how the Mediterraneans eat.
He's talking about in your book, I believe.
Yeah, he's talking about the book. And essentially what happens is people start looking for lessons from humans. And today in this world, when we have airplanes and food is basically distributed all around the globe, Japanese and the French, they're not as unhealthy as we are. I mean, they're eating croissants, and the Japanese are eating rice, and the Jews are eating bagels. It doesn't really matter, you know. Whatever culture you're in, you know, whatever culture someone's in, they're eating carbs. And
right,
so
right,
to
right.
get some culture that has a carb-free diet, you're not going to find one. So the only way to really get an answer on how to lose weight is to look at animals who are either insect eaters
right.
or carnivores. There's no such thing as a vegetarian, first of all. Vegetarians and vegans ask me, I'm giving my kid a vegetarian diet. There's no such thing as a vegetarian nature because everyone's eating insects. This is why the Jewish people, to keep kosher, we have to check our plants of insects
right.
because there's tons of them in the plant. So even a vegetarian thinks they're not getting any source of B12. They're getting B12 because they're eating insects. But essentially, there's no such thing as a vegetarian. Even a koala bear, who they thought was a pure vegetarian and pure vegan, no, it's not, because it's getting insects from
uh-huh.
the thing. Even a cow, they thought was a vegetarian, no. The cow is getting worms and insects
right.
from the soil. And elephants, when they dig, you know, they're also getting ants and worms and insects from the soil. So there is, we have to stop this notion of thinking there's such a thing as a vegan or a vegetarian. There is no such thing. And the funniest thing is my book is all about the environment and all about animals and animal protection. But ironically, humans are carnivores. We have canines. We chew in an up and down motion like carnivores. We don't chew in a rotary motion like a sheep or a lamb or a cow. We don't have that. They used to say in the 1970s, like, oh, if you took the intestines, you could spin it after the moon of a human. It's not true. Humans, for our body size, we have the shortest base intestines for our body size of any animals. This is in the book. You can see all the charts. And we're closer to like a cat and a dog. So we're essentially carnivores. The ironic thing in my book is I'm telling people, eat a more vegetarian diet. Because that's the healthy, refined way of eating is more vegetable.
If I can mention, like, for instance, we see an instruction in various places that, first of all, it says don't guzzle wine, don't eat too much meat. And even by the most sanctified piece of meat we eat the whole year, which is the Paschal lamb, we're only supposed to eat, to fulfill our obligation, the minimum is just an olive-sized portion. Now, how big is an olive size? But an olive size is not 2 pounds of sirloin steak.
Right. So what we have all these supermodels and actors in Hollywood going on the Zone diet or the Atkins diet, and I think they figured things out now that it's probably closer to Atkins. Most famous physicians I spoke to on the phone, including Dan and Mary E's clinic and speaking to Barry Sears, you have to go to a very low amount of sugar to lose weight. And so most people are really going Atkins, but they don't tell you that because they don't want to be associated with the Atkins, the stigma of eating hot dogs and hamburgers. But the thing is, you have a lot of actors in Hollywood and a lot of people promoting steak and salad diet. So steak and salad for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. If you take that to the consequence 30 years from now, if we were to go with the Atkins approach or even the Sears approach, but eating a high meat Sears approach, 90% of the rainforest destruction in South America is due to one industry and one industry alone, which is the meat industry.
Right.
So, I mean, Torah tells us we're allowed to use animals, we're allowed to wear leather, we're allowed to wear shoes, despite what the animal rights activists think. I'm a hugest, my book is all about the environment, it's all about animals. I'm a huge animal protectionist, I'm against cruelty to animals and research, but the Torah says you're allowed to wear a leather jacket, you're allowed to animals for your benefit, and the animal essentially, Kabbalistically, if you understood, they want to get to a higher plane, they want to be eaten and reincarnate as a higher creature, so this is a good thing. But when we eat meat, steak and salad diet 3 times a day, what we do is we become like a raven or a lion. And the Torah tells us to keep kosher. We're not supposed to eat lions and bears. And you see this even amongst Jewish people. They don't even really realize it, but it's like, why? Well, you don't eat a lion or bears. Why not? So we're not eating ravens, squirrels. Some people, you know, that you see them eating all sorts of escargot, snails, and frog legs, and the elite. Okay, so I'm not saying Jewish people don't eat these foods from time to time, but...
Those who don't know the dietary kosher laws.
Right, they don't know the laws of kashrus, but even the nations of the world outside of, like, these barbaric countries in Africa, they're not eating dogs and cats. It's considered inhumane. The reason is...
Well, I think in China, though, there is a group that they have a sermon, which is, it's against the Noahide commandments. They actually have the monkey in the middle of the table. They remove the top part of the head, the skull,
right.
And they actually eat the monkey brain while it's still alive.
Yeah, see,
that is strictly
Jew and part of the Noahide laws. Even Ronald Reagan, when he was president, he passed a law that all the nations of the world and the United States at least should keep the Noahide laws, which are part of the Ten Commandments. And one of them is you're not allowed to be cruel to animals. You're not allowed to rip a limb off an animal while it's still alive and eat it. The notion of animal cruelty, it's in the Torah. So even when Jewish people, they call me a tree hugger or they call, you know, the environmentalist tree huggers, I find it an ignorant approach to Torah, because the Torah does not want us ripping down rainforests to get steak and salad diets. And it's not going to refine a person. It's only going to make a person more coarse and more crass when he's eating guzzling meat. When the Jews were in the desert and they were begging for meat, it wasn't enough that God was providing them with manna every day they were there. They protested and they were punished for it, essentially. They had the meat coming out of their nostrils. And so that's what's essentially happening in the rich nations today. We have too much meat production. The rainforests are getting chopped down, and it's affecting the environment. Anyone who looks at, I'm about as conservative, by the way, as can be, but I'm a big fan of Al Gore, his books on the environment and the planet. And as a scientist researching his book, it seemed very valid research that it's having effect on global warming. It's causing the ice caps to melt and seas to rise. And, you know, certainly, if I had to sum it up, I would say most of the temperature issues and global warming issues, whether you believe it or not, it seems that it's not so sustainable for us to be eating meat as suggested in the Zone diet and the Atkins diet. So my book is sort of a modified Atkins diet, but it's mostly vegetarian. So it's kind of ironic because I'm telling people you're a carnivore, but I guess you could say we're a refined carnivore or we're a humane carnivore, meaning we only eat that which we need to help us work, to help us do what we have to do. And in fact, every time a Jew eats, he has to sit down to the meal and say to himself, I'm eating this only to serve my Creator.
That's right.
And all the nations should have this in mind. It's a good practice.
Intellectually,
and it helps
makes
a
sense.
Person from
it
overeating.
Makes sense. If you believe in God, you're eating, you're drinking, should for the sake of strengthening your service to God and fellowship with human beings.
Right. And anything that's not being used for that purpose, that's left on the side.
Then, Dr. Sarlin, I don't even think we've scratched more than an inch off the tip of this iceberg of what we want to share with our Blessed Soul audience here about what you're involved in. And I hope, as we come to the conclusion of now the show, unfortunately, that we can in fact continue in this series. I had 10 questions which I had reviewed with you. I haven't even got past question number one. So I just think there's just so much involved. And I hope, hopefully in future shows people can call in and ask you questions. I want to thank you very much. And again, how can people connect to you to learn more about your book? And also, Dr. Sarlin does phone consultations, and he also practices in New York City. So please do a little share some information how people can connect to you if they want to learn more.
I have a private practice in New York, and they can. There's a lot of information available on my website in terms of natural health resources and information about how to get off chemotherapy and some of the dangers of chemotherapy on my website. So there's a lot available for reading on my website, and if someone wants to get in touch with me, the number is there to get in touch with me if they have any more questions.
So give them your website, please.
So it's drbensarlin.com, and I don't turn anyone away to financial reasons, so feel free to call me. And thanks so much for having me.
No problem. That's drbensarlin.com. Also, how can people buy your book, Everything They Don't Teach at Harvard Medical School? How can they buy
the book? Is available on the website, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and
And hopefully Dr. Sloan talked, he is the book, he is the source of the book, and hopefully in a future show, Ben, we'll I'd like to quote from the book, and then you can take the ball and run with it, because in this 200 page plus book, I know there's a lot more knowledge that you have than you distilled into the book, and I've talked with musicians. A product, when you talk about, even when an artist makes the greatest album ever, it's never a finished product, because in their mind they could have played it they could have added more bass and treble and volume, and I know in your book you could have added more, and hopefully let's get more people buying the book. You can make a second, third, and 15th edition and add more information. So this is Don Siegelman reminding everyone again that in this world where it seems that there seems to be a lot to be concerned about and a lot to be worried about, I'd like to ask you and suggest to you and even humbly bless you and wish upon you to breathe easy, take it easy. We're on the show with Lady Rub and a hot new artist, I believe, is going to be also trailblazing the future of Jewish and all just good music. This is called Breathe Easy. In the meantime, best of souls, I want to end, as I usually do, with a Ahava Chad, one love, Goyal Chad, one destiny, Kalana for all of us. Badach Yisharim, in the peaceful of Darkenom, in a pleasant way, Laham Shik, to be considered, Lezashem Yisbelech, with the help of the Most High. And here we go. Thank you, Robin. Robin, breathe easy.